Welcome to Shut Up at Ride. Oh, I'm a bit croaky this week, So excited since coming back from the UK to be back recording, but we've got no Saimi. Saimi is teaching the millions of people all around the country. He is too busy. And next time when he's back on, I'm sure he will moan about being tired because he just says yes to too many things. But I am joined by now. He is a daddy. The lovely Benji. Ben, congratulations. You've had a baby. We're not here to talk about that, sadly, because we've got to wait for Simon. But how are you?
We are all amazing. Me and George and baby Wild. We are all having the best time. And yeah, I think as the, pride comes before a fall, maybe a bit of hubris here, but this baby thing's easy. He just sleeps, poops, eats. We are smooth sailing so far. Yeah, we're really good.
Our next
really
guest is laughing heartily at your comments, by the way. laughing heartily. Can I just say, this baby bit is all right. I found that quite easy, because if you can keep a horse alive, you can keep a baby alive. My children are now 7 and 6, and that's when it gets tough, because they shout in your face. So I'm going to laugh heartily when the smile is left from your face. but for now, can you just, before we introduce our guests, please tell everybody your child's full name, because it is epic.
Our baby's name is Wild Lysander Atkinson. So he's a little boy.
It's just so cool.
Wild as in Oscar Wilde, Lysander from A Midsummer Night's Dream, and then, of course, Atkinson on the end. Yeah. Wild Lysander Atkinson.
Amazing.
It's a strong name.
I was Peas Blossom in Midsummer Night's Dream once, and I was quite chubby as a child, so my parents called me Peas Pudding for the entirety of it. But that's a story for another day. Right, we must bring in our guest. Now, first of all, really excited to have this guest on for many, many reasons, but also because from the start, we've said that this podcast would try and find answers for the listeners. Everyone's coming on a journey with us. And I'm just so delighted that someone from a federation has agreed to come on our podcast. This feels like a little moment in history for our little pod that is growing. But I am so delighted to welcome the CEO, that sounds so grown up, doesn't it? The CEO of British Dressage, Jason Brautigam. Jason, thank you so much for coming on the pod. It is so nice to have you on.
I'm delighted to be here. Thank you very much for inviting me.
First of all, how are you? How is life? Sod the dressage for a second. How are you yourself? How's it going?
We're all good, thank you. Having a very busy start to the year. I don't know why, but we don't seem to have a quiet period anymore. It used to be that sort of January, February, March, you could sort of use those months to get your house in order, get all your plans in place and get ready for the year ahead. But literally we hit, you know, the ground running from the first week in January, and it's relentless. It doesn't stop for the rest of the year. Dressage is very much a 365, 24/7 sport these days. So, you know, it doesn't stop, but that means there's never a dull moment. It keeps it interesting.
Exactly. And I have worked with you. I've had the pleasure of doing lots of presenting and work with British Dressage. I've hosted the Fan Zone when it first came about, and I've actually interviewed you before. So we know each other pretty well. My question to you is, have you heard of the very handsome, wonderful Ben Atkinson before? Are you aware of his presence within the horse world?
Of course, his reputation goes before him. Now, I'm very impressed with the following that you've developed here with the podcast, and looking forward to being part of today's discussion. Very impressed as well by Ben's son's name. Very literary. I did American and English literature at university. I'm very impressed by that heritage, and has a lot to live up to with a name like that.
Yeah, I know. My wife warned me. She was like, he better turn out to want to do weird stuff like you do, because if he wants like a normal life, this name's cruel. She did say that. But everyone in our family's weird. George had a real job and then she ran away with the circus. So, you know, we'll be fine.
Yeah. Ben's wife is actually a farrier as well. They're literally like a powerhouse team.
Brilliant.
So, Jason, we know you're a very busy man, so we will get stuck into it. But I think one of the first questions is people want to know, because obviously we see all the articles that get put out by British Dressage and we see the statements that get put out and your name is plastered on them. The CEO of British Dressage says, But I feel like we actually don't know what, why you are the CEO of British Dressage. What can we just find out a little bit about you? What's your background and how you kind of ended up in this role of leading the BD around the country? How did you get into this?
Well, it's quite an unusual path, really, because as probably people who are more familiar with my background and story, I've never actually sat on a horse, which obviously makes me somewhat unusual within the equestrian world. But I do always think that that's a benefit too, because I can be perhaps a bit more objective. You know, I have no sort of baggage. I have no hidden agenda. I have no particular association as a rider or a coach or a judge or an official or anything like that. So I've been able to come into the sport and sort of see things from an objective viewpoint. My background was primarily in horse racing. I spent 25 years working in horse racing, but I've spent my entire career working in equine sport. So, you know, I've got a real passion for that. Where the transition to the equestrian world really came about was after London 2012. Obviously, I was absolutely absorbed with the Home Olympics, as everyone else was. Loved every minute of it. And I was in contact with the Olympic disciplines at the time. I was running my own independent sport marketing agency, and offered my services and said, if there's any opportunities for me to get involved, please let me know. As it turns out, my predecessor, Amanda Bond, she had an opportunity to go and work for the Hong Kong Jockey Club. I was very familiar with them and the work that they do. That caught my eye, and the opportunity opened up then to be Amanda's successor at British Dressage. So I ended up taking that on in the spring of, I think it was 2014 now, so not long after London. And I've been there over 10 years. Everyone said I wouldn't last a year. And look at me, a decade on, I'm still there.
That we were talking about this earlier, Ben, weren't we? Because our sponsors, who I have to mention, Charles Owen, and I'm sure I know you've you know Charles Owen very well, Jason, and the CEO indeed, Dave, who we adore. Can I just say our sponsors are amazing on so many levels, not just being a title to this. We're really involved with them, and they're absolutely brilliant. But Dave, again, he wasn't from an equestrian background, but I feel like that can only be an asset, and he's really been able to see things in a different way. Because I feel like with, excuse the pun, but we can be very like blinkered on, us horse riders. We put our blinkers on, and that's the way it should be done, and that's how things. So, do you feel that's been an advantage to you not having actually sat on a horse?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's quite an insular community, as you say, and they do tend to see the world through their own sort of bubble. And it is quite difficult sometimes to sort of look at the bigger picture and the context that the sport is in terms of the society as a whole and the wider sporting community. So I think it's been beneficial in that respect that I've been able to come in, having worked in a different sport entirely. Obviously, horse racing is very different, has lots of different benefits in terms of the commercial structure that it operates under. It's, you know, but actually, I probably thought there was more commonality between horse racing and the equestrian world. And actually, there's very little overlap. Culturally, there isn't. And I think that was the biggest challenge initially. It was a culture shock, not just for me, but for everyone in dressage too. So it took us a while to get on the same page. I mean, I think my first sort of 12, 18 months, I just did a lot of listening and learning. You know, I just sat down and spoke to so many different stakeholders about their view of the world. And I was just like a sponge, just absorbing it all, really, because I didn't want to come in and presume that I knew the best way to do things, shake things up, rip it up, start again. I'm a very firm believer. Not only do you, if things aren't broke, you don't try and fix it. You try and build upon the foundations that people have put in place beforehand. But also it's a process of evolution, not revolution. You've got to take people on the journey with you. And if you don't get everyone on board, and everyone's sort of sharing the same sense of direction, the same purpose, the same vision, then it will fail. Fortunately, you know, we have done that, I think, in dressage. You know, everyone did get on board, and the sport itself has just gone from strength to strength over the last decade, since London 2012, through obviously Rio, Tokyo, now Paris. But the whole pyramid from, you know, the elite through down to the grassroots, we've had a really positive period of growth in British dressage, and I think everyone in the whole sport has played their part in that.
Do you think that at the moment, so you said that like one of the hard parts is that you need, you know, like evolution opposed to revolution, like the idea of you need your people who are involved with the sport, both competitors and spectators, to be on board so that you can implement change. Do you think that especially with the current climate and the way things have changed quite drastically in sort of the last 12 months in the sort of public psyche, both within the equestrian world and outside of it, that it's given you a larger scope for larger change at this time? Because for the first time in a long time, everybody seems to be singing from the same hymn sheet in terms of the evolution they would like to see in all aspects of equine sport. And I just want to point that out as well. It's not just a dressage thing. It's like you say, dressage, jumping, racing, yeah. Even in the liberty that we do. For once, it feels like there's more people on one, or like unified together than ever.
I think there is an appetite for change, for sure. But I'm not sure everyone's necessarily 100% in agreement just yet. I think people have different views on what that change needs to look like and what sense of direction needs to be. I think part of the challenge is exactly as you say, trying to get that consensus. So what does that change look like and make sure that everyone is pulling in the same direction? I think everyone has the same intent. So in other words, we all want the same thing, which is we want to have a sport, an equestrian community that is built on solid foundations. When it comes to equine welfare, it comes to equality and inclusion, and comes to sustainability and so on. So I think that we have commonality in that sense, but how we get there, I think, is still open to question, because obviously you've got to respect the traditions and the heritage of the sports themselves and take people, as I say, on that journey with you to what the future might look like, because change is inevitable. It's either change or be changed, and you've got to constantly grow all the time and constantly evolve, and society has changed. You know, mm-hmm. over the last 10 years, we have seen attitudes towards horse sport change and shift, and we need to be alive to that, yeah. You know, and respond accordingly.
I think I just wanted to say as well, before we move too far away from it, like we've said about yourself, like Dave from Charles Owen, I have a online education company called BAM, Ben Atkinson Method. And there are three business partners in it. And there are two of us who are mad for horses and liberty. And the third partner wouldn't know which end had the head and which end had the tail. And it works perfectly because they're also, I think people can forget sometimes when they're calling for their sort of, I don't know, revolution, is that, yes, it's a governing body, but it's also a business. And so if you want the governing body to exist and to continue existing, it also needs to stay a viable business. And like, so I know that even for us in BAM, we'll have some things where me and Larissa are like, let's do this. It's going to be amazing. And Suresh is like, yes. And if we do that, we'll be bankrupt in 2 weeks. Not yet. No. Like, and it's finding those balances. And the reason I just bring this up on the podcast is I think people can sometimes see these governing bodies as if they're Moses on the Mount. And that you could carve new rules into stone and the world shall change and everything shall be better. But it just doesn't blooming work like that. And it, like you say, it takes a lot of time.
And I think the other thing that people don't realize is that actually everyone plays their own role in that. You know, we are a community. Ultimately, BD is a membership organization as much as a national governing body. You know, we're a charitable organization and we're there set up for the benefit of our members and the benefit of the sport. But we can only do these things collaboratively and collectively. There has to be a sense of shared purpose, a shared sense of direction to make sure that we all move and make progress in the right way. Because otherwise, if we just dictate from above and leave our members behind, well, that's a waste of time. You know, you can be very dictatorial in terms of rules, regulations and everything else. But unless you bring your members with you, then it's pointless. Ultimately, we're still a membership organization. We see it very much as a community, the dressage community, as part of the wider equestrian sector. And it's incumbent upon all of us to work together. We all have a role to play. Otherwise, things won't really fundamentally change.
And one of the reasons we're here, and we've got to bring it up, but before we do bring up what's the last year, I just want to also congratulate you on what was an amazing summer. And I know then it turned into an amazing winter and London Olympia was amazing with Lottie and Becky and and then Amsterdam and Becky Moody. We're big Becky Moody fans on this podcast, by the way. We are huge Becky Moody fans. But I just want to, first of all, that narrative of out of what was not the greatest of moments for British dressage, but out of it has come this amazing talent that I think, unless you follow the dressage, you may not have known about Becky so much. But I just want to congratulate you on what was an amazing Olympics and brought so much joy to so many, and the kind of stories that have come out from it afterwards. And also what came out of it hugely was this passion and the love of the horse. So I just want to say that because it meant so much to us what they achieved out there and to so many people.
It did. And, you know, the Olympics are always the shop window for our sport. And so it is vitally important for us. And we're very proud of the team, what they delivered under quite difficult circumstances at the time. But actually, the sad part of it, in a way, is the events of last summer did overshadow the fact that it was a record-breaking year for British dressage. We actually won a record number of medals across all age groups and categories. So 15 medals in total. Children on horses for the first time. Our ponies, juniors, young riders all performed superbly, as well as our seniors and our paras. So, you know, to come away, we actually had 3 gold medals last summer. And actually, it's a shame in a way that I felt it was a little bit overshadowed by other events.
I know. And that's the thing, isn't it? That's what the Olympics does in so many ways. It makes it puts everything into the limelight, whereas actually, as I've got worked with you for years, and I, you know, I'm a massive support follower, and I'm very good friends with lots of the para riders. The Paralympics gets a little bit overshadowed, like you say, by the Olympics, because those riders, they are just phenomenal and such amazing advocates for the sport, and all really good fun, by the way, on a night out. I've had my best nights out with the para team.
Well, do you know what the incredible thing was last summer with both the Olympics and the Paralympics is every single member of Team GB came home with a medal. And I think that's an incredible achievement itself. So that's eventing, show jumping, our senior dressage team and our para dressage team. Every single one of them came home with at least one medal.
Amazing. Absolutely amazing. I don't know if you've listened to the podcast, but I get very emotional, Jason. There's a lot of tears that get shed because for me, I love it. And, you know, I'm so passionate about the sport. And I think this is a good time to kind of go into what's been happening. But I ended up sobbing during the Olympics. I was sobbing because my kids are there screaming at the TV because obviously they know Carl and they know Laura Collett and they know, and they're there shouting. And I was watching them just like, I was very passionate and upset because my husband came upstairs. He's like, why are you sobbing? Laura's just gone clear. What's going on? And I was just like, I'm just worried that my kids will never be able to watch horse sport at the Olympics. Like, this might be the future for us. Like, I've grown up with it. I'm friends with Lucinda Green, who was the flag bearer at the LA Olympics. And it would just had this dawning on me. I was just absolutely terrified that my kids might not grow up now knowing that this sport that I love so much is on this world stage being showcased for everyone to see how amazing it is. So obviously, we've got to talk about the Charlotte incident, and I'm as much as you can. But when you wake up to news like that, and obviously you obviously knew before it came out, can you just take us through that process and what you can talk about and how you even get your head around dealing with something like that, not just on a kind of huge level, but on a personal level? Can you take us through what kind of happened as much as possible?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was such a difficult time for everyone. And we found out literally only hours before the rest of the world, really. You know, the email arrived in the inbox of the FEI, the BEF and BD on the Monday morning. We obviously quickly convened and decided how we were going to sort of approach this in terms of our course of action. But by the time it had gone to Tuesday, within 24 hours, we know that the media outlets already received a copy of that video. We knew that it was going to explode, you know, and these things quickly take on a life of their own. It was, you know, in all of my professional career, I've never experienced anything quite like it. When you're in the eye of that media storm, that maelstrom that goes on around you, it's just relentless and almost impossible to control or influence, you know, because it's something that you're just caught up in that eye of a storm. And we were on every radio, TV, newspaper, podcast, you name it. Every phone in, every sort of magazine show, we were headline news on every single channel. It was crazy. Our little sport, you'd never imagine, would be in the spotlight like that, was suddenly, for a 72-hour rolling news cycle, absolutely at the center of attention. So, yeah, the sheer volume and ferocity of it all took us all by surprise. And you mentioned being in tears. I remember watching it on Good Morning Britain, along with everyone else, and I too burst into tears. I was, you know, on a personal and professional level, it hit me hard, you know, very hard. With every all the work, all the hard work that we've done to build up British dressage over the last 10, 20, 25 years, I felt that, you know, it felt like the rug being pulled from under our feet. And we were so much looking forward to Paris. You know, we had the opportunity there where we could have had potentially the most decorated British female Olympian of all time. And we were all looking forward to that. Literally the night before the news broke, you know, there was a lovely feature on BBC News on the 6 o'clock news about looking forward to Paris for British dressage. And then bang, you know, our world just falls apart overnight. And I don't want to be sort of melodramatic about it. But, you know, like I say, I've never experienced anything like it in my professional career. I hope I don't have to again. It just wasn't pleasant for everyone. And, you know, and it did affect everyone. I think that's the other thing to emphasize. Every single person I know within the dressage community were affected by it, you know, and it had a huge emotional impact upon everyone. So, you know, it was incumbent upon me and for BD, we needed to sort of step up and try and show some leadership. Obviously, the case needed dealing with in terms of the disciplinary action with the FEI and the BEF. And obviously, we were dealing with that from a governance point of view. But more importantly, in terms of the PR aspect and the reputational damage that something like that does to the sport, we needed to get to grips with it very quickly to make sure that actually we were being more proactive in terms of communications and actually presenting a positive view on what we're doing as a national governing body and have been for a number of years on the equine welfare front. Because, you know, these things don't happen in isolation. But, you know, the fact is we had an equine welfare action plan in place long before the Olympics. In 2023, we launched our charter for the horse. We had a new revision of our equine welfare policy booklet that we produced in conjunction with World Horse Welfare. We had a whole range of tools available for our organizers, venues, and our officials. You know, we've invested a hell of a lot into our training and education programs as well, particularly the development of an online e-learning platform. And that was all around horse care, equine health, good stable management, and so on. All of that work was already in progress. But of course, the problem is people don't know about that. And so in a way, having the spotlight shining upon the sport, it was incumbent of us to actually say, actually, you know, we are trying to lead the way on this subject. We are trying to deliver change. But it's very difficult because people look at the national governing body and, you know, like to point the finger of blame towards us too. And yes, we all share our responsibility. But, you know, I was determined to use this incident as a catalyst for change, that we can actually start to change people's perception and start focusing on the positive progression and the positive changes that are needed within the sport to actually present a different image to the public.
Just it just makes it, I just can't imagine how you guys must have felt. And I having worked with you guys in the team and everything, like managing everybody, because everybody who's worked in British dressage all are riders and are passionate about the sport. So just hearing how emotional you got about it, just again, I was welling up again. I was getting very emotional. There's so many questions come out of that. So obviously then you've got to take on an Olympics. And I think the team did incredibly well to do what they did under such enormous amount of pressure. How much was going on behind the scenes managing what the media were trying to do, because they are the ones that are going to shape the public perception. How did you respond to what the media were then kind of doing? Because obviously how they I know a lot of the riders were like, when they'd won their medals, that the media were coming up to them and saying to them, oh, can we talk about the Charlotte incident? And they're like, no, we've just won a gold medal. Can we talk about that? how were you guys protecting the riders, and how were you able to then shape the public perception of our sport?
Yeah, I mean, it was a combined effort for both BEF and British Dressage. Obviously, the world-class team were already out in Paris as the news broke. And they did a fantastic job actually working very closely with the athletes to put a protective bubble around them as much as anything else, to insulate them from the media storm that was going on, particularly back here in the UK. British Dressage, our focus was managing sort of the media fallout here at home, and trying to make sure that that didn't impact upon our teams and upon their performance. And that's not just, again, the senior team. This is across all of our age groups who are out there preparing for the European Championships as well, not just the seniors at the Olympics. So our job was to try and protect them as much as possible, but, you know, deal with the media storm that was happening here in the UK. And then world-class support team did a fantastic job. You know, Winnie is very experienced, as you know, our head of communications at the BEF, and working very closely with the athletes, made sure that, you know, they were protected as they went through that mix zone. You know, we wanted to focus very much on them and their moment in the spotlight and not take away from that in any way, shape or form. And the fact that they were able to not just go into the arena and put on their best performances, but to deliver the medal. And that bronze medal felt like a gold. I couldn't have been. I mean, of course, it was very mixed emotions, but I couldn't have been more delighted for them, for Becky in particular, who I know really, really, you know, was thrown into the deep end there, you know, at the 11th hour, to have to go in and not just make your championship debut, but to do it on the biggest stage in the Olympics in the Palace Versailles, yeah. You know, in that spotlight, in that moment, to produce
on
what she did.
On a very hot Jaeger bomb, she informs us. It was a hot bomb.
Yeah, exactly. But all three members of the team, they just really pulled together. You know, Carl always is, you know, does such an unbelievable job and sort of anchoring that team. And then Lottie coming out too and producing her best. And I think the way that they managed to rise to the occasion, the important thing for us was we didn't want anything to take away from their moment in the spotlight either. As I say, that bronze medal was a gold as far as I was concerned. You know, and yes, again, there were lots of tears, lots of emotions running through that whole week in Paris. But, you know, it felt like an enormous achievement. And there was a huge sense of pride that, you know, we still managed to go and get on the podium and win that medal.
We've talked a lot about the sort of the aftermath of the incident and then Paris and all of that. But one thing I'm really interested in is now we've got a bit of space between us and that. And now things seem to have got their feet underneath them. And like you've said, at the start of this podcast, you mentioned how there used to be an off-season, now there isn't. So within reason, from a business point of view, you can look at it and say, even though there's more negative talk in the social media space, obviously as a business, it's flourishing. As a sport, it's flourishing. What are our big thing on Shut Up and Ride whenever we talk about the incident? Which also, can I just laugh at the fact that it has become the incident and everybody knows exactly what we're blooming talking about. As always, actually, side note, have to point out, there were actually about 6 or 7 videos that came out of different people doing different dodgy stuff. So it can't all be put on one person, firstly. So let's just say that in different aspects of equine sport. But as we've moved away from that, our Shut Up and Ride, our question is always, don't cry over spilt milk. What's happened's happened. What comes next? What do we do? What do we do next? So leading on from that, what sort of things have you guys thought about? The public must have given you lots of opinions, which you will have loved.
Yes. Well, there's never a shortage of opinions, both from inside and outside of the equestrian world. Of course, back in that period of time, probably for a good 2 or 3 months after the Olympics, you know, I was personally still responding to, you know, several hundred emails a week on the subject. You know, we did have a huge volume of feedback from all sorts of people, both positive and negative.
How many, I just ask, Jason, on that note, how many were equestrians? Did people track you down from outside of the equestrian industry, or was it mainly from the equestrian world, would you say?
Both inside and out. So,
really?
In equal amounts. Obviously, in the immediate aftermath, there was a lot more of the general public sending us messages, whether it's via email, telephone, calling the office and so on. Longer term, it's probably been more from within the equestrian world. But as I say, I think one of the challenges that we've got is that there isn't consensus within the equestrian world about what needs to happen and what that change needs to look like. And I think that's part of my message to everyone, is we all need to get on the same page in this and all start pulling in the same direction. Because unfortunately, a lot of the time, the criticism comes from within. And actually, equestrians are not their own best friends. And, you know, a lot of the criticism, a lot of the negativity, a lot of the infighting is not going to help the sport long term. So that is absolutely a key message. But taking a step back from all that and to answer Ben's point, we have to remember how far the sport has come. You know, we talk about the success that we've enjoyed on the international stage from London through to Paris. But, you know, you compare that. Back in 2012, we had 13,500 members. As of Paris, we had over 19,000.
Incredible.
So we've grown considerably as a sport, you know, from being the smallest Olympic discipline to the largest, you know, and that has a huge responsibility with it. You know, we've gone from one season to two, where we have a summer and a winter season now. We have a championship for everyone, if you like, at all levels, from grassroots up to Grand Prix. So everything from our club members who compete at Quest and Associated Championships, up through the area festivals, the regionals, the Premier Leagues, the National Winter Championships. There's a whole pyramid, and we've broken down a lot of those barriers that existed to participation by making sure that the sport was accessible and as inclusive as possible. And, you know, it's now a very, very broad church within dressage and within equestrian as a whole. And I think, you know, we mustn't forget how far we've come. So what I've said to my team is that actually this year is about regrouping. We need to consolidate that growth, you know, and look to build on those strong, solid foundations that we've put in place. So, you know, a lot of hard work has been done. There is no need for the events of the last 12 months to actually undermine any of that good work. It's about regrouping now and saying, okay, how can we rebuild or build on those strong foundations to actually ensure that the sport has a secure, long-term and viable future? I mean, you mentioned, Jenny, incidentally, about the our future within the Olympic program. And of course, there's never any room for complacency. But actually, in terms of the metrics that the IOC measure success on, which is bums on seats, watching the events, the televised audience at home, the viewership, and also the social media engagement, actually, on those three metrics, dressage and equestrian disciplines were right up there this year. You know, so we performed really well.
Better than breakdancing, Jason. Better than breakdancing.
Exactly. So there are absolutely a lot of positives to take away, even from this summer. You know, so I think we need to be confident in what we do as a sport. As a sport, I'm talking about all Olympic disciplines now. But as I say, there's no room for complacency. We need to make sure that we walk the talk. You know, we can say all the right things when it comes to equine welfare, about the horse being at the heart of everything that we do and equine welfare is paramount. But we've got to make sure that that is absolutely true at every level of the sport and feeds from the top down and from the bottom up. And by that, I mean, yes, you can put all the rules and regulations in place that you like. You can put all the good governance structures. You know, we have our whistleblowing policies. We have our equine welfare policy. We have our charter for the horse. But only if people actually follow that
and
put
read
that into
them.
Practice.
Yeah,
read them. But also they live and breathe them.
Yeah.
I mean, the fact is, you know, people have a responsibility. Everyone within the equestrian community has a responsibility to put all of these things into practice at home. That's what the whole charter of the horse is supposed to be about. 24/7, for the lifetime of the horse, we have a duty and a responsibility to ensure that that lives, that horse has a fulfilling and well-lived life and existence. You know, and we can talk about the three Fs. The five domains of equine welfare or animal welfare. All of these things are great on paper, but we have to live and breathe those values. And that's why for me, it's how that then comes to life. Mm. So for as a national governing body, we're putting a lot of investment, as I say, into the training and education side of things, particularly our educational programs. We launched our e-learning platform at the end of last year, and that has our horse care program, our equine health and stable management modules within there, and that's available to all members. We've had education and awareness on equine welfare topics on the BD website and social channels, such as our vodcast series that we did last year with Alan Davis. We all love Alan, our super groom. We've invested in market research in partnership with World Horse Welfare. And again, that was released earlier this year now. You'll have seen a lot of progress being made on that front, which helps to inform how we need to change public perception in order to earn their confidence and trust. And so that was really informative research. And we've also been doing a lot of investment into scientific research as well to provide further data and evidence on the correct use of tack and equipment, focusing on the well-being and the comfort of the horse. So there's a lot of things being going on in the background, but what we need to now do is bring them to life. And that can follow every single element of the sport, as I say, from the governance through to the training and education, through to our communication with not just the equestrian audience, but the wider public. But most importantly, the fundamental essence of the sport itself has to evolve and change. And that's what we're working on now in close conjunction with the FEI to say, are we actually operating the sport in the way that encourages best practice, that rewards a harmonious and natural way of going, that encourages correct use of tack and equipment, that actually goes back to the basics, the fundamentals of dressage, which is all supposed to be about good, harmonious method of training, building that partnership between horse and rider. So I think we almost have to go back to basics as a sport to ensure that the correct riding and the training methods are rewarded, you know, so that we're focusing on harmony over tension and submission, you know, that we have clearer guidelines for officials on the correct use of our aids, our tack and equipment, and we assess the inputs as much as the outputs to improve the level of consistency in judging and to improve the standards of riding as a whole. And as I say, that goes right the way through the whole pyramid. Yeah. So it's a huge task. I'm not saying that it's it's not. But I think all the fundamental elements are in place. We just need to change the focus and almost start at the end point and work backwards. What do we want that? What do we want the sport to look like? What picture do we want to present to the public?
So when you
backwards
when
from
you
that and say, okay,
when you say that, you mean almost what do we the public, or what do we the governing body, or all of us, the collective we, how do we want a Olympic level gold medal winning Grand Prix test to be ridden? And then within reason, once we know what that looks like, then a little
on
bit
a
like,
unicorn without a bridle and no shoes on its feet.
I can do that.
It's the challenge, isn't it? I mean, this is the challenge. I mean, you know, we can have all the discussions about double versus snaffle, bitless bridles, the use of spurs, etc., etc. And I think, you know, there are debates to be had, but we mustn't get bogged down in the detail. You know, almost you can get lost. You can't see the wood for the trees. And actually what it is taking a step back from that and saying, actually, we want to be able to present the sport in the best possible light that shows that it's all about the correct method of training and developing that harmonious partnership that is based on a happy, healthy horse enjoying what it is doing, and the horse and rider working in partnership together.
I'm confused when you say sometimes that gets a bit muddled down so that you can't see the wood for the trees, because what I would also, before I do this, I am the uneducated aspect of the podcast. That's why I am here. I am here to ask stupid questions. So please feel free to point them out if I do. But from talking to people from our events and social media, and from, you know, my wife, Tom Pete's dressage, you know, friends like that, to me, it seems quite simple. It seems like there are many things, not even drastic rule changes, but almost options to come out. Like for example, let's go for a tired conversation. Like, what the compulsory double bridles and spurs at a certain level.
This is what I mean about getting bogged down in the detail and not seeing the wood for the trees, is that, you know, I think that's the wrong hill to die on, you know, to say that, you know, traditional classic dressage, it has to be ridden in a double bridle. We need to actually take a step back and say, actually, what we want to do is make sure that our tacking equipment is used correctly, and that actually we're using the right tacking equipment that is appropriate for that horse and for that rider. So it is at national level, we have the double bridle or snaffle as optional. You know, and I don't really see personally, and again, I have to emphasize, I'm not a horseman myself, and I know there are very strong different views on this, but I don't think that there is any real issue in just making that optional at international level too. I know that there is, you know, question mark about the consistency of judging. How can you make sure if it's not a level playing field? But I genuinely believe that, you know, and we've seen it, you know, we've seen even recently, Laura Tomlinson won national titles last year in a snaffle. Yeah. You know, there, it can be done. So, and I didn't see any issues with the judging then.
Like you say as well, when they say it's not a level playing field, I sort of had this out with Becky Moody when we interviewed her, because people say double bridles make it a level playing field. But then when I pointed out to her, I said, oh, so you, Carl and Lottie could all have swapped bridles and your horses would have gone the same. And they're like, oh, no. And I'm like, no, because your doubles are all different. So it's still not a level.
But that's the thing. It's about the solution that's right for that individual horse and rider. And, you know, again, I don't think we need to be too prescriptive about it, because, you know, the recent study done by Centre Biomechanics showed that actually there are equal concerns about the snaffle as there are. So
it's because bloody dressage riders want to clamp that jaw down with a flash. Come on, boys and girls. You can ride with a snaffle without a flash. It will not kill you. You won't get bolted with.
But the point being is, with a snaffle, you've got one point of pressure, whereas actually with a double, it's split over 2 points.
Yeah.
And that's what the research was showing, that actually, in terms of overall pressure on the horse, that... actually, the double, arguably, when used correctly, spreads that pressure over two contact points rather than putting all the pressure in one area.
Yeah.
So it's all about the correct use of tacking equipment and making sure that we've got that education in place.
Yeah.
And about riders choosing the options that are right for them and their horse.
The tools are only as good as the person using them.
Before we wander too far, I was just going to say, Jenny, sorry, let me quickly get this in before Jason gets absolutely sick of me. Because I have to ask, because as Jenny was just about to say, we asked our fans if they had any questions. And this is where we said that you were the most popular guest so far, because we've done this a few times and we don't get loads of questions. And we asked for you and we got loads. And so, as you know, like, I'm a Liberty person. I play around with horses with no tack on. Haha, it's great fun. But that means that a lot of my followers are from the abnormal horse world. So I have to ask the question for my people. Will there ever be a world in which people could compete bitless at BD?
Yeah. It's literally, I would say, 60% of the questions are bitless and nosebandless. Can we ever do it? Will you ever be a world?
I want to save you some time by saying... I personally think there are some bitless bridles that are much, that can be softer, but I also think there are some bitless bridles which are actually face crushing monstrosities. So I don't think bitless necessarily means better. But yeah.
And this is the point. It has to be based on, again, good research, scientific evidence, and data. And we are currently looking at that. Through our partners to actually do further research and understand exactly as you describe, are bitless bridles actually good for welfare? And are they actually just changing or moving the problem into different areas? And I think we need to understand exactly how those mechanics work before we make any long-term decisions. If I could take a slightly different view, though, just on this point, I think we have come a long way in the last 10 years as a sport, you know, in terms of classical, traditional dressage through to where we are today. As I said earlier, we're far more inclusive, far more accessible than we've ever been. For me, I think personally, and again, this is a personal view now, this is not me as speaking on behalf of my board or organization, but I think that there should be a place for people to compete in bitless bridles if they want to do so. Again, it's all about what's right for them and their horse, providing they are used responsibly in the right way and that tack and equipment is fitted correctly. And we are certain that actually it's not putting undue pressure on the horse in other ways. So again, it's all about that harmony between horse and rider, making sure that we're using the tack and equipment that is right for that individual combination. How that is incorporated within the sport, obviously, is a big question mark. I know it's hugely controversial, hugely contentious, because the historically, the essence of dressage is all based on acceptance of the bit, and how can you actually even begin to judge that on a level playing field if you've got bitless bridles? Now, that's a debate that needs to be had. But for me, first and foremost, we need to be able to understand, are bitless bridles actually beneficial? Do they actually make a positive difference? And if they do, how can we incorporate that within the sport? The good thing is, I think, is that nothing's off the table. You know, we have a blank sheet of paper here. We have an opportunity to actually review everything and have that conversation. We're obviously very interested in what's happening elsewhere on the continent, where other countries like the Netherlands and Denmark and Sweden, they're looking at these issues as well. And I think collectively we're seeing that the dressage community and the wider world are probably more open to these things than they have been previously.
Yeah,
I don't think anything is going to change dramatically overnight, but you never say never. And from my perspective, as I say, as a national governing body, we want the sport to be as open, as accessible and as inclusive as possible.
If it helps at all, I think you could make a lot of money. If you open some bitless competitions, there's some money in the bank to be made there. Just saying. Because the people want them. Just put them in their own class.
Well, exactly. I mean, there is an opportunity that, you know, if we talk about level playing field, if we agree that bitless bridles are a serious proposition and a positive way forward, then, of course, then we could be looking at things like separate classes. We could look at the way in which they can be managed. We haven't, you know, as I say, it comes down to the very essence of the sport. It would require a huge amount of training and education of our officials, too. So I think there's a long way to go yet. But it, as I say, it's something that I think we're very open to having that discussion.
And just so I'm clear, so we can kind of summarise for the audience, because there is a lot of people wanting this. And there a lot are saying, why are we not doing Denmark's taken away bits and the Netherlands have taken away nosebands and New Zealand have taken away nosebands? And that feels like it almost might be a knee-jerk reaction. And what you're saying is you're doing the science. And this
I think we have to. Yeah. I mean, you take, I mean, if I could just add another controversial subject into the mix.
we love it. Go for it.
You know, blue tongues, for example.
Yeah.
You know, it's become a hot topic now within the sport. There's no avoiding the fact that this is, you know, again, highly contentious, but we don't necessarily understand the science behind it. Even the veterinary community are not, don't have a universal opinion. You know, there is a lot of discussion, even amongst the experts, about, you know, is blue tongue a thing? What causes blue tongue? Are there ways in which that can be avoided? You know, is it down to particular tack and equipment? What can we do to address that? And that's not just a dressage thing. This obviously goes across every discipline. It goes across the entire equestrian world. I don't think there are any easy answers, but what I do think is that we need to have more evidence. We need to have the knowledge. We need to have the understanding in order to inform our decision making. As you say, you can be. It's very easy to be knee jerk about these things and to just think you can put in other rules and regulations that are going to suddenly stop the problem. That's not the case. Of course, it's part of the solution. And, you know, we've got the new noseband measuring tool coming in. The FEI are introducing from May this year and will be rolling that out next year as well. And I'm sure that will make a positive difference. But it's not this isn't just a single solution here. This is a bigger topic for discussion. And I think it needs to be evidence based and we need to have the knowledge. And I totally get that, you know, the welfare organizations will be saying, well, you should be taking the precautionary principle here and actually making sure that you act sooner rather than later. But we need to beware of unintended consequences. In the same way that we talked about the pressure points for the double versus the snaffle, or comparing bits to bitless bridles, we need to be careful that we actually base these decisions on the science, the research, the information that's available, and we avoid any potential pitfalls with unintended consequences that could actually be worse for horse welfare longer term. And that's what I'm concerned about. Yes, we're on that journey, and yes, there is no room for complacency here. We'll move as fast as we can, but we don't want to be knee-jerk in our decision-making. We have to make sure that it is evidence-based.
And I'm guessing as well, what I think from a person who loves horses, and I wouldn't be knee-deep in following dressage articles and rules and regulations, but I feel like, and that's the case for a lot of people, a lot of the articles, obviously I'm doing my research, Jason, coming on to this, I read a lot. I read the survey that's been done. I've read the Charter of the Horse, which, by the way, people, go and print that off and stick it up on your yard. That is there and it is accessible. But I feel like we as riders are not good at wading through reams of information. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if there is a better way. Like, listening to you here, I feel like your passion is coming across and how much you want to improve and how much you are open to this. And if I can say this, I feel like maybe sometimes that doesn't come across on British dressage socials. And actually, I'm really enjoying chatting and talking to you. And I don't know, maybe there is a way of British dressage breaking down this information to make it easier for us mere mortals and the people who aren't, because I think a lot of people doing the shouting aren't necessarily even British dressage members.
Well, I don't know. That's the thing.
Yeah. Making this information that you're saying to us and the science and even little like snippets of, yep, we're starting this study today, or do you know what I mean? I don't know. I feel like sometimes we have to make it even more obvious for us. Well, and hearing your passion and starting with this here now.
Part of the problem is there's a lot of misinformation out there.
Yeah, and, absolutely.
You know, this is an issue for the wider society, and it's not specific to equestrianism. We're seeing it all, in all walks of life.
Absolutely.
You know, from our politicians all the way down, you know, that there's a lot of misinformation, disinformation, and actually social media, in the age of social media, you know, people always look to highlight the negative.
Yeah.
They want the controversy. They want the clickbaits. They want to focus on the negative. It's very difficult for us to sort of, surrounded by all that noise, to cut through and to try and focus on positive good news stories and get on the front foot and be proactive and try and present the sport in a positive light, because no one wants to actually listen to that at the moment. You know, you've got all this negative noise around you, even within the equestrian communities. I say, you know, we've got people within our sport who are actually doing more harm than good. They're actually bringing the sport into disrepute. And I think we all need to work together to promote those positive images, the positive messages that we want to present to the public. You know, we talk about the tack and equipment, for example. And I think, again, we're getting bogged down too much in the detail here. Yes, they're important elements, but actually we need to flip things around and say, you know, and I've had these conversations with Rowley at World Horse Welfare.
Oh, I love Rowley.
Rowley's fantastic. And, you know, they had a fantastic conference in the autumn in terms of what makes a happy horse. And that's what we need to be focusing on here, is that ultimately there are two athletes here, and the equine athlete needs to be the prime focus here. We need to give a voice to the horse.
Yeah.
So what does a happy horse look like? And I think we need to educate people in very simple ways. As you say, break it down so that actually we incorporate some equine behavioral science and sports psychology. But we actually, instead of focusing on the negatives, the pain indicators and so on and so forth, we actually say, what does a happy horse look like? How can we ensure that we listen and understand our horses a lot better, so we know actually that they are enjoying what they do and they are willing partners participating in dressage? This is not something we're imposing upon them. And as part of that, we focus on more training and education around horse care in terms of stable management, as I say, the correct use of tack and equipment. All of those things are really important, But I think we just need to break it right down into its most simple form. Because the reason I get up in the morning, the reason I still do what I do, and the reason why I was able to pick myself up and dust myself down last summer.
It would have been very easy to chuck it all in, Jason, I have to say. It would have been very easy to bin out on us.
Exactly. And the reason I do what I do is because, you know, you've got, what, 90% of our members are just, they're single horse owners. They live, breathe, eat, sleep for their horse. You know, their love and passion for their horse, it comes through in everything that they do. And I just wish the wider public could see that as well. You know, we're talking about, as I say, we've got 19,000 members. The vast majority of them will be competing at grassroots level and, you know, are just there enjoying that partnership, that relationship, that bond that they have with their horse. We've got to find a way of conveying that out to the wider public, but also helping to support those members to understand, again, making sure they've got strong foundations in horse care, stable management, and understand what their role and responsibility is in terms of a horse's care and well-being. And then we can work together as a community to present those positive images and messages to the wider world. I do think you're right. I think, you know, sometimes, and I'm very guilty of this, people criticize me for talking corporate speak too much. You know, we need to break it down into sort of everyday language. But that's what we wanted to do with the Charter for the Horse. And that's why that is on. We've distributed that to every single BD venue in the country. We've got posters on display at all of our affiliated venues. Those posters are available for download on the website. As you say, you can print it. You can put it up in your yard. We've got our equine welfare booklets too. And what we try to do is break it down and make it really easily digestible. So you look through our equine welfare booklet, for example, and we talk about everything from your sort of care for your horse at home, whether that's in terms of forage and nutrition, access to water, space, access to being turned out and so on and so forth, through to traveling to and from competition, how you care for that horse before and after a show, the warm-up arena, and obviously competing itself. Our role has expanded, I think, far beyond just what goes on within the white boards.
Yeah.
We have a responsibility and a duty of care, I think, as I say, 24/7 now, to help our members understand what is required to look after a happy and healthy horse around the clock, and not just while they're competing with BD. It's what is referred to in the FEI's research as the other 23 hours. And that is vitally important.
I think I agree with you. It's all very important, but I think it's definitely, as much as I agree with you that it's the entire life of the horse, not just the hour it's worked or competed. But I think definitely for the first time in my life, I saw a definite change. Every year, my wife and I go to the London International to watch the dressage and the freestyle, and the public spoke very clearly there because the London International do that thing where they allow the public to sort of score it as well, don't they? And I found it fascinating how there were horses that would do terribly officially that the public would score very high, and horses that would do brilliant officially that the public would score very low. And I think I agree with you. That's where the biggest change has gone. Dressage is doing brilliantly in all the measurable metrics. We brought home lots of medals. We've got more members as part of the societies. There are more shows going on. But I think a big feeling I get from seeing people now, and it's almost like you say, it's a cultural awareness. We've become culturally more aware, not only of our own emotions, as we've seen conversations throughout human society about sexuality and gender and emotion and depression and, like, you know, all of those things. And I think that has bled into our interaction with our animals, and people now saying, well, actually, it's not enough for me for that horse to win because it did the cleanest ones and the most rhythmic piaf and passage if it needed to be ridden in that manner to achieve it. And so that's something, it's everything you're saying is filling me with so much confidence, but I hope that in the future we can see that reflected more at competition. So, like, in here's an aspect of the horse world I'm sure you didn't know existed. Medieval jousting still happens competitively internationally. There you go. There's a fun bit. But sometimes the riders get points for how they strike and where they strike. They also get points for horsemanship. And a rider can have all the best hits in the day and still not win because he didn't get those horsemanship points. He didn't ride the horse or make the best decisions for the horse throughout that round. And I think what makes this the muddiest topic when it comes to any of this is none of us are telepathic. None of us can speak to horses directly and say, this is a happy horse, this is an unhappy horse. But I think there is a...
But that's why that education piece is so important, Ben, because, you know, we need to understand more. You know, there is equine behavioural science out there. And I think we do know a lot more now in terms of a horse's positive indicators and not just negative ones. You know, and we talked about, obviously, friends, forage, freedom, and adhering to the five domains of animal welfare. But developing a happy, healthy athlete through harmonious education has to be the very essence of dressage, you know, to ensure that horses have a life well lived, and not just a safe environment that's free of pain or illness or anything else. This is a horse that, you know, enjoys participating as part of that partnership in our sport. And we have a collective responsibility to set the standards. You referred to the London International Horse Show. It's interesting, you know, again, the feedback from the dressage community as a whole is very mixed, because actually a lot of the feedback I've had from technical experts said that the standard of dressage there was very high. And people's methods of riding, the riding that was on display there, was a very high standard. And I was there in person as well, both in terms of the warm-up and the watching the competition. And there was nothing there that I saw that would genuinely give me any cause for concern. And I think the riders now are very mindful of their responsibility. And collectively, we all have a responsibility. We know that we're under the spotlight, and we want to make sure that we're presenting that positive image. It will take time to change the culture, however. I mean, you mentioned certain things like the Piaf and the Passage. You know, is it correct that we ask so much of the horses at higher levels, certainly at such a young age? You know, should we increase the minimum age? Should we actually look at taking away the coefficient marks? Should we put greater emphasis on give and take of the rein rather than the more difficult movements like the Piaf and Passage, for example? Yeah.
But why can't that be both?
Be as long as they are.
Do you know?
Sorry?
Like, to me, a lot of those things that you're saying can live in harmony. Do you know, you can still give points, like, or maybe there is a like you say, like, it is muddy now, I'm just starting to do it in my mind, but when you're saying about whether the PF or Passage is really good, or whether it's the give or take of the rein, but can't those two things live in harmony? Like, if you have a perfect...
They can, but it's a question of emphasis, though.
Yeah, but well, I think surely the emphasis has to go towards welfare, because I find it interesting. Is it from a public feedback or a research feedback that you guys have invested so heavily in the other 23 hours? Because I've never heard anybody say, like, you know, oh, I worry that Totolas didn't have enough rugs on or get the right hard feed when he wasn't in the ring. I don't know. Maybe I'm echo chambered.
Well, I don't know. I personally think that, you know, actually what I've seen over the last 10 years in British dressage is that attitudes have changed. People are interested in what happens outside of the arena. You know, the fact that Vallegro and Utopia were turned out in the paddock and frolicking together at Carl's Yard, you know, those images that would be on Carl's social media channels had far more clicks and likes and comments than anything else that happened within the dressage arena.
Yeah.
You know, people want to see that horse is happy and healthy at home, and is well cared for and looked after. So I think, I totally take what you say, that, you know, maybe, you know, the focus still should be on the sport itself in terms of what happens within the arena and making sure that is 100% correct. But it is only one element of looking after any equestrian horse in any discipline across its lifetime. And, you know, that's certainly something that racing's been looking at, for example, you know, looking at everything from cradle to grave, that lifetime care for the horse, which hasn't always been there in terms of the traceability and what happens after its racing career. And so I think, you know, we do need to make sure that we are all responsible horse owners, and that we take that responsibility seriously for that lifetime care.
Do you think there's ever a world where, because obviously there is the worry that what goes on for the other 23 hours, do you think there's a world where the top riders have to be more accountable for the other 23 hours and show the welfare, because they're the ones who are going to have to lead the way. Because I've been on many a yard where people go, oh, I don't turn my horse out because I don't think I should because it's a dressage horse. Is there a world where the top riders will have to kind of be a bit more transparent about what goes on in their yards the other 23 hours of the day that we don't see them riding?
Well, inevitably, I think, you know, those at the top of the pyramid who are competing internationally, they're ambassadors for our sport. And of course, you know, they attract a great deal more of attention than anyone else. But that's why I think now in the age of social media, we can sort of give a peek behind the curtain, if you like. You do see what goes on at the yards. You do see at home. So you see those pictures of Carl turning his horses out, or Lottie getting up early in the morning to go and feed all her horses. And, you know, you see all these things on the social media channels, and actually it makes those elite riders very human. It's not just about their performance in the arena. It's about how they look after and care for their horses and demonstrate that they are just as passionate and just as much interested in caring and looking after for their horses as that grassroots rider who owns just their one horse.
So it's a fascinating thing. It's like people seem to have this idea that it's like, yeah, you can only love your horse until you've won this level of medal or this amount of money, and then you stop. And it's just ridiculous. Like, it's like people, you see it from the general public a lot, and they're like, oh no, they're too successful, they must be horrible. And you're like, how on earth, how do you think you get there with a horse if you don't have a passion for horses?
Well, look at the relationship that Becky has with Bomb, for example, you know?
Yeah.
And the fact that you've got so much support for Becky is largely as a result of, you know, the way that she has communicated with the dressage audience and beyond, with Bomb's blog, and you know, doing those fantastic social media posts that are really engaging. And I think her love and passion for her horse comes across very loud and clear. So yes, absolutely, the elite riders have a huge responsibility. They're ambassadors for the sport, but you know, it's definitely heading in the right direction. There are more positives than negatives. Like I say, people like to focus on the negative, but when you look at you know, Lottie's social media channels or Becky's blog for Bomb, you know, there's lots of positives out there. Again, if people want to look for it rather than focus too much on the negative.
Yeah.
So we have been talking for well over an hour, but I really want to ask this question, Jason, because a lot of people have been asking about it on social media. So we are not advocates in any way, shape or form of people having vicious opinions on social media. We hate it. And I'm sure you're very, very aware of a certain social media site. I will not name her, like Voldemort, because I do not want to give any airtime to this website, but on Facebook. But one of the things that person does on Facebook is highlight issues within the industry on any of the platforms, but mainly dressage, so we say, and I'm sure you know who I'm talking about. And this is the reason, people, I'm not mentioning her name, because she is absolutely vile and I don't want to give any more clicks or likes to her or people going searching for her. But it is highlighting some of the issues that's going on. We do not want people to be on social media slagging people off. It's not the way to move forward in our sport, and I cannot stress that enough. But if people are worried or see something at a show, what is it should they do? What can they do if they are concerned about horse welfare issues? And how can British Dressage help in that way, so people aren't reaching for the keyboard?
Yeah. I mean, I think there are two parts to respond to your points there. One is, I think you're absolutely right. The keyboard warriors are not doing anyone any favours here. We have critics from within our own sport that seem determined to just bring the sport down. They are focusing on purely the negative rather than the positives and not having a balanced argument or discussion or debate at all. As you say, it's clickbait. It is sensationalist and hugely damaging.
Mm-hmm. And just mean. Nevertheless, don't be mean, people.
Well,
be kind.
Exactly. It's all about be kind. And we've got a Be Kind campaign coming up, actually, next month, so watch this space.
Yay! We love a bit of kind.
Actually, it's in mid-April we're starting, just at the winter. I think the important thing from my perspective is that we are very open and transparent in everything that we do. You know, there is no hiding place, and nor should there be. I'm quite happy for us to have a very open book policy when it comes to equine welfare. And because I think it's important that we do discuss things like double versus snaffle, blue tongues, noseband tightness. You know, these are issues that, yes, we need to wrestle with, and we need to come up with the right answers. So I'm not hiding from any of these things. And as I say, we can use the events of the last 12 months as a catalyst for change. But collectively as a community, we set the standards that we expect others to adhere to. So we all have a duty and responsibility not only to uphold those standards, but to report others when we see that they are perhaps not adhering to our equine welfare policies and are sadly in breach of our rules and regulations. If anyone has any concerns on that score, there are correct channels open to you. Don't go on social media. Don't do the keyboard warrior thing. Don't shout for clicks, because actually we will take these cases seriously. As the national governing body, we investigate every single case that comes across as our desk. We have a whistleblowing policy in place, so you know people can see that actually we'll try and protect the confidentiality and anonymity of individuals if we have to, but we can only act when we have evidence. So we need to have those videos, the photographic evidence, the witness statements. We need to be people to work with us to give us that information so that we can weed out any malpractice. And if there are bad apples in the sport, there will be no hiding place for them. You know, we are determined to clean things out. And there is absolutely no grace or favor here, no matter who that person is. And no matter what their profile is within the sport, we will not hesitate to act, because we are serious about eradicating any abuse of the horse and making sure that we all adhere to our equine welfare standards. But too often I hear that, you know, well, you know, I don't want to say anything because I know it will come back on me. Mm-hmm. Well, at some point we have to say as a community, no, I'm sorry. We are going to stand up for what's right. We are not going to accept that practice. We're not going to accept what goes on behind closed doors. You know, we're going to actually weed it out. We can't do this on our own as a national governing body. We can set the rules and regulations, but we need people to come to us if they've got evidence and concerns so that we can actually act upon it.
Yeah. And how do people find the information if they actually were concerned? I'm guessing it's all on your website. Yeah. Is there a page or?
It's all on the website. We have equine welfare page that includes our policies, our documents, but also an equine welfare feedback form. Anyone can use that form to send back to head office. We actually have a dedicated email address, welfare@britishdressage.co.uk. Perfect. Or they can come to CEO@britishdressage.co.uk. I will personally review every single email that comes into that inbox, I promise you. Wow. And, you know, that actually, you know, we take every single email that comes through to us seriously. We work with third parties. So if it's a serious civil case, we sometimes have to work with the police or local authorities, or we might work with the RSPCA, Blue Cross, World Horse Welfare. You know, we can't do anything on our own. We don't have the jurisdiction. Our responsibility as a national governing body is basically what goes on at affiliated competition and training that is run under the auspices of British Dressage. However, if there are members of British Dressage that are a breach of our rules and regulations and are guilty of abuse of the horse, we will work with those other authorities who do have the jurisdiction to hopefully take action as required. Okay. But we do need help and support of the whole community in order to do that.
And another one that we've brought up a lot of the time and a lot of questions came in about it is obviously stewards. I've seen it in eventing and competing where some of the top riders have, and obviously I'm always in a warm-up. You know me, I've got a microphone, I'm always in a warm-up. I would say less dressage, more show jumping, but I've seen some pretty bad behaviour on part of the riders and I've seen them spoken by stewards, and the kind of stewards is, they always look a bit terrified. Is there going to be a place where there is more power to the stewards? Because oftentimes they're volunteers, aren't they? They're lovely people who just want to have horses and want to have a nice time and make sure you're helping run the show.
To be fair, that's very remiss of me, because I should have mentioned this a lot earlier on. As part of our equine welfare action plan, what we're actually doing is investing in a comprehensive steward development program.
Oh, wow.
So those who are familiar with British dressage will know that we overhauled our whole judge education program a few years ago. Just post-pandemic, we rolled that out. We're going to be doing exactly the same now for our stewards in terms of the training and education and development program to actually promote and professionalize the role of stewards and give them a more prominent role within our sport. We want to expand the use of stewards to other competitions, making sure that, you know, welfare modules are fully embedded in all of our training and education, our CPD activity, whether you're judges, stewards or volunteers. And importantly, we're looking at potentially longer term, not overnight. We've got to get the stewards right first, but potentially longer term, establishing a new voluntary role of welfare marshals at regular day-to-day competitions.
That'd be amazing.
So that we will have people who have eyes and ears on the ground who are able to make sure that, you know, people are doing the right thing, not just in the competition arena, but in the warm-up and at the stables and so on. We need to review our welfare guidance that we give to our officials to ensure that there is a consistent approach across the board. But we are creating a program of webinars, workshops that focus on equine welfare to ensure that we maintain consistent standards across all of our education programs for our coaches, our judges, our stewards and other volunteers.
You need to get, you know, like the police have those little body cams.
Yeah.
So they can, well, that would be amazing.
Yeah. I mean, this is the thing, you see, we do, obviously when we have any equine welfare incidents, whether that's eliminations in the arena because a horse is unlevel or lame, or whether it's because there's been, a misuse of tack and equipment and aids in the warm-up, we do have welfare forms submitted by our officials to head office. Every single one of those is logged and recorded. And we've actually now employed a welfare and officials officer for the first time, who started at the beginning of January, who actually whose full-time role is to work with those judges and officials to monitor and track all of our welfare concerns. And again, I'm very keen that we have a very open and transparent approach on that. So we will be reporting on that to our members.
Amazing. Do you ever see a world, Jason, where Benji's world, and I mean, we went to Gareth Hughes's yard, didn't we, Ben? And Gareth was like, I've got a horse. I want to teach it to lie down because it's like, I want to be able to help it because it never likes to lie down. And like Ben was helping Gareth. And do you think there's ever a world where these guys, British dressage, embraces the natural, like, you don't like being called natural horsemanship, do you? The liberty world and the way Ben works with his horses and amalgamating the two a little bit?
I see no reason. Again, this is a personal view.
Yeah.
I see no reason why not. I mean, for me, we've already proven in over the last 10 years that as I said earlier, dressage is a very broad church. And we want to make it inclusive and accessible to everyone. I mean, you take our para community, for example, and we've got the FEI Para Forum next week where classification is a hot topic.
Yeah.
One of the issues I've always had with para dressage is that it focuses purely on physical disabilities. And, you know, we want to look at disability in its broadest term by looking at those who perhaps have neurodivergent needs, those who have hidden disabilities, and, you know, and other mental health conditions. We've tried to look at this in its broader sense and say, what can we do to work with other third parties, whether it's, the RDA, Virtus, the Activity Alliance, Sport Excel UK, those people who are experts in those fields, to actually open the doors to dressage and make it fully inclusive to all, regardless of your level of ability or disability, whether that is physical or not. And I think the same principle applies across the piece. So in terms of natural horsemanship, for example, providing we think that that is conducted in an ethical and responsible way. And again, I'll come back to the points I made about both bitless bridles and the snaffle versus double debate. It has to be based on evidence that actually it's good for the horse. And for me, as long as we start with the happy, healthy athlete, and that the horse is actually a willing partner in in that activity, then we should make it as broad and as accessible as possible. There's room for everyone. And we've done that with our associated championships too. You know, we have breeds of all shapes and sizes competing in dressage now. And, you know, it's actually become our most popular championship. We had over 1,400 combinations go down the center line in the autumn last year. And so I'm determined and committed to sort of making sure that, you know, dressage is genuinely, truly accessible to all.
What do you think, Ben? Can I just say, you've got to make sure that the horses are willing participants when it comes to Ben. I think sometimes it's the other way around. Malik, one of his horses, is very much the boss, and Ben has to be the willing participant in Malik's performances. Yeah.
I was just
absolutely.
I was just really smiling because I had my little list of questions, and then just in that last little piece, you seem to have gone on and ticked them all off. Like, I had lots of messages from people to talk about the Virtus stuff, like you said, for the more classes for people with sort of mental impairment and stuff, and the para classes, and people maybe not even just asking, but just wanting to praise you publicly for your involvement in all of that and how amazing that is. And then I had lots of questions asking me to ask you about which different types of breeds of horses would be allowed at BD. Would a Suffolk Punch be allowed to compete at BD? And I hear, like you said, all shapes and sizes, you're welcome. And I think people shouldn't forget
Absolutely.
That. We talk about dressage as a sport. No matter what you do on a horse, you do dressage. You might do it terribly or you might do it well. But if you're riding a blooming horse, you're doing dressage. So, like, if you want to jump or whatever, yeah.
And it's that's exactly it. The essence of dressage is all about good training. And if we stay focused on that, then everything else becomes easy. Genuinely, we overcomplicate things. You know, it's not about having your expensive warm blood. You know, yeah. You can do it on. We've had, you know, young kids and Shetland ponies
on a mule. Wasn't there a mule at one point?
There's been more than one mule, yeah. you know, mules and hinnies and all sorts. But you know, why not? You know, your Suffolk Punches, your Shire horses. They've all, you know, your Hairy Cobs. They've all got a place and all got a part to play. And you know. The work that we've done on the hidden disability side, particularly working in partnership with Virtus and the Activity Alliance on the non-visible disabilities, you know, those that are on, that either have neurodivergent needs or, you know, who have difficulties in other ways, you know, it's a complex area and very much in its infancy, but we are committed to continuing to grow that area of the sport if we can.
Yeah,
I would love to see a world where I know, like when I've been at the national championships, and I don't know, I'm just now spitballing ideas. We do this a lot on the podcast, but you know how we had the fan zone? How cool would it be to have the training zone where, like, someone like Ben is sat there for a couple of hours, or then Carl's sat there for a couple of hours, or whoever is the amazing trainer? And if people are just at their lorry going, oh, my horse has done this and I don't know what to do, or a mental coach, or I'm really nervous before my competition, they could just pop in and have a one-to-one or get some tips or advice, or I don't know, just having that support network at shows where you can go and ask a question. And like, again, someone like Ben, like, my horse won't load, Ben. Can you go, what advice have you got? Or my horse is terrified of flags. But then at the same time, I'm really worried about my ones today. Carl, what would you do if you were stressing before your ones, before you went into a test? I don't know. I feel like I've come into this not knowing how this was going to go. I'll be completely honest with you, Jason. I thought maybe it would just be, I don't know, you never know how someone's going to react and just be reading off a sheet. But I feel like you've been so open and honest with us. And I feel like there is so much going on. And that hopefully people listening to this will be reassured by that you guys are working tirelessly behind the scenes. And the fact that you keep bringing it back to horse welfare. And that's what we're about. It is the love of the horse, and it feels like, even though you've never sat on one, there feels to be so much passion.
I hope so, because it is absolutely a genuine passion, and it's a real mission of mine to really deliver on this. You know, I'm always very keen that, you know, I firm believe that actions speak louder than words. This isn't just words, and you know, I do get emails from concerned members of the public and also the equestrian community that, yeah, you know, you're saying all the right things, but actually, you know, what are you actually doing about it? Well, we want to make sure that there are some tangible outputs here, which is why when we put the Equine Welfare Action Plan in place, it's all based on practical things that we can actually deliver, you know, make a difference and make a change. We can't do it on our own. As I said, it has to be everyone playing a part within the equestrian community. But certainly, you know, there is a determination there. And as you say, a real passion to use, well, not just use the events. Let's forget about the events of last year. We want to do this because it's the right thing to do, right? Mm-hmm. It's the right thing to do. Let's face it. It's nothing about sort of responding to the negative public reaction to that incident, as you say. It's about actually doing the right thing and ensure that we have a long-term sustainable future for the sport. I firmly believe that there is a place in society for horses and also a place in society for the use of horses in sport. Clearly, there are some activists, there are some groups that don't agree with that at all. We've got to be able to work collectively to put a positive case forward and to demonstrate actively as to why we are ethical and responsible horse owners and why we deserve to have that public trust, confidence and respect. And you can only do that by being open and honest and having these debates. Yeah. You know, there's no point. If you try and keep things behind closed doors, then you'll only have suspicion and mistrust. And what we're trying to do is be very open in our approach and saying, look, this is genuine. We're trying to do the right thing here. We're trying to move the sport forward positively in the right direction. So work with us, help us. And, you know, we will hopefully have a positive and sustainable long-term future.
And I think it's very positive. Not so much a question, but just a statement. Like, so reading up more, obviously I've always known that British dressage exists, but obviously we read up on everything before coming into this interview. And the reason I have so much confidence in everything you're saying about how you want to move forward to increase horse welfare is, like you've said, the amount of work you're doing to help those people with disabilities be more involved in dressage, the work you're doing for mental health, the programs you've had to make equestrianism more accessible to all people in all walks of life. And so you can tell just through the things that you've been doing that you've seen what the public have wanted in the past and made it happen. So you're listening, and you're going to do it.
We genuinely do listen, honestly. So, you know, I welcome feedback from not just our members, but the wider equestrian community and beyond. You know, we're always learning. We're always evolving. And as I say, the only way you can do that is by listening to people and learning as you go. So, yeah, we don't necessarily always have all the answers, but we're certainly a progressive national governing body, and we're always trying to move things forward in the right direction.
So, final question, Jason.
Yeah.
If a member of the general public walked up to you today and asked, why should we support dressage in 2025? What would your answer be?
So I would come back to what I said earlier, really, about I would focus on that individual example of the person who lives, breathes, eats, sleeps for their horse, that cares for their horse probably more than they do members of their own family.
Yes. You know,
they certainly spend a lot more money on them than they do for the rest of their family.
Yes.
And you know, the fact is that most people who are participating in our sport go out there for the love of the horse. They are all about developing that bond, that special relationship that they have between horse and rider, and trying to actually work together to enjoy that relationship in the arena, to put the essence of good training into practice, and to make progression as a partnership. And I would invite anyone who's just a member of the public who hasn't seen what dressage is all about before, and who thinks it's unnatural, in inverted commas, to make horses do those movements, to just go behind the scenes, to go and see a grassroots rider do their training at home or at their livery yard with a coach, and see what it's like in practice. Because actually, I think, you know, it's not just my passion, but their passion will come across too. And I think people, when they realize that actually our sport is generally filled with people who have a genuine love and passion for the horse, that actually that will be the biggest way that we can change public perception.
They are the dancing ponies, and there's always some cool music as well. Watch them dance. They do love to dance. And when you've ridden a horse to music, you know how they actually hear it, and they do move with the music, and they do love it.
Yeah, well, actually, my other passion in life is music. And one of my big criticisms of the dressage world is the appalling taste in music that a lot of our dressage riders have. So the one thing that it's still my mission in life is to sort of drag the dressage world kicking and screaming into the 21st century in terms of its musical tastes.
Yeah.
Can I just say, we always ask our guests what's annoyed them this week. So would that be the what's annoyed you this week?
It hasn't annoyed me this week, but I can assure you, when you've listened to the same Disney theme tune 20 times over at the Winter Championships, then yeah, it can be a little bit mind blowing. I want to see dressage horses in there to the Chemical Brothers, you know, yeah. And
bit of Stone Roses.
Exactly, you know. Let's sort of modernize the sport in a different way.
Only if we could get them to do a bit more kind of, I don't know, a more sort of Ibiza chill music, and we can sit on the side with a cocktail, Jason, that would be wonderful.
Even better if we can do it on the beach.
Yes.
Yes.
Down there somewhere on a Spanish island. That would be my ideal.
Beach dressage.
Yeah.
I absolutely love it. Right. Well, Jason, normally I end this podcast by telling people to shut up and ride, but I think in your case that the ride part will leave out. But can I just honestly thank you so much for coming on. And we would love to have you back, wouldn't we, Ben?
We'd love it. Yeah, it'd be amazing.
Well, it's been my pleasure. I've really enjoyed it. I love having these type of discussions. And as I say, you can judge us by the progress that we make. I'm more than happy to come on in 12 months' time and hopefully demonstrate what we've been able to put into practice.
That would be amazing. And if you feel like there's any updates or anything that you guys, especially any scientific breakthroughs, we would absolutely love to have you back on. You've been absolutely brilliant. And I honestly feel like I can feel your passion for it, and I can feel some of the emotion that's been behind the last year. And huge congratulations, not just to you, but to your team as well. I know there's a big team there that worked tirelessly to try and make British dressage what it is. And there were lots of comments on social media about how amazing British dressage is as well. So I want to feed those to you as
well. Well, that's very kind of you. It is absolutely very much a team effort. And I'm very proud that we've got a fantastic team in place at BD. I'm very proud of the organisation. And, you know, when I was very emotional last summer, I felt a huge sense of responsibility sitting on my shoulders too, as sort of head of the organization. But also I'm very protective of my team, my staff, you know, and not just our employees, but the wider community of volunteers and the network that we have at British Dressage. So many people put so much hard work. They put their time, their energy, their passion, their commitment into the sport. You know, my role is merely to help facilitate that. You know, these are the people that make it happen. They're the ones that have all the technical knowledge and expertise and know and understand the ins and outs of the sport. I'm just there to help and support them along the way and give the sport a bit of direction and guidance. But we've got a fantastic team in place. And all I would request is, you know, to our members, to the wider equestrian community, let's just all get on board. Let's all start pulling in the same direction. Forget the infighting. You know, we all want the same thing here. So let's all try and make sure that we're fully aligned and build a brighter future and ensure that there is a long-term future for equestrian sport.
That is perfect. Just the perfect way to end. Let's build a brighter future. Ben, as always, you're the handsome legend. Jason, thank you so much. And I'm just going to end with just shut up and make dressage the wonderful world that it is. Thank you so much.
Thanks very much. All the best.